house is a fine little house, Jack.
Are you allowed to speak along the way? I was thinking there might be rules.
Let me put it this way. Very few make it all the way without uttering a word. But do carry on merrily. Just don't believe you're going to tell me something I haven't heard before.
That was maybe a mistake.
What was maybe a mistake?
Me getting in this car with you. You might as well be a serial killer. Sorry, but you do kind of look like one.
If you feel like screaming, I definitely think that you should. Nobody wants to help! Some people claim that the atrocities we commit in our fiction are those inner desires which we cannot commit in our controlled civilization. So they are expressed instead through our art. I don't agree. I believe heaven and hell are one and the same. The soul belongs to heaven and the body to hell. Think about all the things I've done in my life without in any way resulting in punishment.
You're listening to Conspiracy Theories in Unpopular Culture. I am your host, Isaac Weisop. As you know, I do film reviews sometimes. And I watched a film called The House That Jack Built 3 years late. But we're going to talk about it. There's actually a lot to unpack here. So, I got to make this 2 episodes. It's going to be too long for one, I'm very sorry. And to be a bigger dick about it, I'm only going to put the second part on my supporter feeds as a way of saying thanks. I know, it's a very elitist attitude, which, goes along with the film. I think the film inspired me that I now think I am part of the elites, the royal bloodlines, and, you know, you should join me. No, I'm just kidding. But as you know, I have supporter feeds, right? You know this. I'm on Rockfin, I'm on Patreon, and then I got my own thing called VIP section on IlluminatiWatcher.com. The links are in the show notes. You heard me talk about it. And I give them bonus content as my way of saying thank you for their support. And I'd love for that to be you as well, my friend. And they'll get part two. Because we've got so much to talk about. In this first part, we're going to talk about the director, Lars von Trier. And we're going to get into the film. We're going to start our journey through this film, which is like 2.5 hours, by the way. Hence the really long film analysis that you're going to listen to. We're going to talk about that in part one. Then in part two, we're going to continue on the journey of the film and then unpack the meaning of that bizarro ending, which I will reveal to you as more Illuminati confirmed, the occult, the alchemy, the spiritual warfare, it's all in this movie. It's all right here. Now, a little background on this movie. It was released in 2018. And you're saying, Isaac, it's 2021, brother. Let me tell you something, brother. It's 2021. It's too late. And I'm here to tell you it's not too late. I've actually had this film on my queue list. Not Q as in Pepe Trump there, but Q like, like the English people say. What do you call it? The watch list. I had it on my watch list, waiting for it to show up free because I pay for subscriptions everywhere. Netflix, Amazon, a $6 million cable bill every month. And I've never seen this movie on any of them. Never. I've got Hulu as well, which is where I saw it. And a big shout out to Eva on the Instagram, she messaged me and said, hey, you got to watch this movie. And I said, yeah, I do got to watch that movie, Eva. You're right. Unfortunately, I'm too cheap to buy it because I don't know if I'm going to like it or not. And sure enough, I looked around and went to Hulu and boom, there it is. So shout out for Hulu. I don't know if it's going to be on there by the time you hear this, but that's where you can find it for free streaming right now. And, you know, look, here's another thing. I get asked to watch a lot of stuff. You wouldn't believe the list, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much. People are always, yeah, you got to watch this, you got to watch this, you got to watch this. Series on, you know, 60-hour series on Netflix. Watch 10 seasons of the show. Watch this movie. And, like, I appreciate it. I actually do read all that stuff, and I kind of keep mental note. And I even have every now and then I'll write lists out and be like, okay, these are the movies I'm going to watch. How often do I get to it? Not too often. With that being said, generally the way to sort of jump up the list is if it's something that interests me, because I am self-serving. Like I said, I am now part of the elites. Illuminate confirmed me. But I like the horror movies. And this one was already on my radar. And sure enough, it was free on the Hulu. So here we go. Let's go, baby. Let's go. You know, there's actually another one that I got to watch. Added to the list. Under the Silver Lake. I've got more requests for that than any other thing on the planet. And I actually am like 45 minutes into it. I've got to restart it. It's another long-ass movie. Another 2.5 hours. But it's got so much in it that I'm like, I don't know. Is this worth talking about? Like, is there anything interesting? I mean, you can see the symbolism for yourself, but I'll do it. When? Sometime this year. That's I'll commit to that. How's that sound? But yeah, okay. Alright. That's all that. And then there's like a show on Netflix everyone wants me to watch about like some hybrids. I watched the trailer and I was like, eh. Doesn't interest me. It's on my list though. Like I said, the list is very long. The only way to like jump to the top of that priority list is if it's, you know, of interest to me. And it's engrossing, and I get into it, and I'm like, okay, this is good. Now, all that being said, you got the vital information. It's longer than 90 minutes. It's 2.5 hours. It's free on Hulu as of this recording. Should you watch this? No, absolutely not. It's satanic filth. It's gory. It's disturbing. You'll probably have nightmares. No, don't watch it. Side note, if you're a degenerate like me, maybe you'd like this movie. It's just, honestly, it might be like the most disturbing serial killer movie I've ever seen in my whole life. Disturbing from start to finish. Really impressed. And as a film, from like a sort of like film critic dork perspective, not that I'm a film critic, I am a dork that watches films, it was actually very interesting. It was actually hard to turn away from. I mean, 2.5 hours. I sat through I burned right through it. Like, dude, this is actually really good. But like the subject matter, the kill scenes are like, it's not for the faint of heart. I will say that. If you're a horror person and you love this kind of gross stuff like me, I'll put it up there with Hereditary, which I kind of thought was maybe the greatest horror movie of all time, in the sense that, let me explain why I think that is. Hereditary and The House That Jack Built both succeeded in invoking emotion into the viewer, into me. To the point where, like, I watched Hereditary in the theater, and I walked and I said, that might be the greatest horror movie I've ever seen. I'll never watch it again. But after watching this movie, now I'm like, I could watch Hereditary again. And I will. I'll try it again. But, like, it leaves disturbing images in your brain. It's very upsetting. It's a very upsetting movie. But, like, you know, like I've always talked about for many years, I'm drawn into these dark things. I don't know why. I can't turn away. I can't quit you, Jack. I can't quit you. So, okay, all that to say this, if you want to watch it, I would highly advise to do it before you listen to these shows. But if you watch it, if you haven't, you know, you heard my spiel. All right, good enough. You get what I'm saying. You're a smart person. Now, I do want to talk about Lars von Trier for a little bit before we get into the movie. Because we're going to get into the movie, of course. But like I said, I got a lot of notes here. Lars von Trier, you know, this the same effect I had watching this movie as I did the previous Lars von Trier movies I've seen. I've only seen four of his movies, okay? I've seen Antichrist, Melancholia, Nymphomaniac, parts 1 and 2, because it's like 5 freaking hours. That's also known as the Depression Trilogy, if that tells you what you're in for. And now, The House That Jack Built is my fourth movie, which are, you know, coincidentally, the four most recent films that he's done. That... the same effect. I'm watching this movie, and we're not doing the plot spoilers yet. I'll let you know when we get to plot spoiler time. I'm watching The House of Jack Bill, and I'm sitting there saying, why am I watching another Lars von Trier movie? Why am I watching these movies? They're disturbing. They make my skin crawl. It's like I'm really looking at evil is what I'm looking at, is what it feels like to me. Maybe it's just like I'm so pure, I'm a good Christian warrior that I can see through the darkness. I don't know. I just, I watch these movies and I'm always sitting here and I'm like, shit, why am I watching this? What am I doing with my life? You know? Now, and that trilogy, so they call it the Depression Trilogy because it's, I guess on some levels, the films are about his depression. I've also heard that The House That Jack Built is also about him and his experiences, which we're going to get into now. I don't know. I mean, you know where I'm coming from when I watch these movies. I see the occult symbolism and messaging, and there's a ton of it in this movie that we got to unpack. Now, Lars is a great example of the changing of the guard. Because here's a guy born in 56, so he's a boomer. And there's a slow rollout of removing boomers from society. And I've, you know, every generation, which those are stereotypes, by the way, to stereotype an entire generation of people to be the same thing, but whatever. But I get it. Like, there's observations and behaviors that, in general speaking, generations have. And in defense of the boomer, like, you know, sometimes I'll crap on the boomers a little bit here and there, you know, but in defense of the boomers, like, they've got a certain resilience, a certain grit, a certain strength that us Gen Xers and millennials and zoomers and all that stuff, we don't have in general. I'm a pretty tough son of a gun. I've been working since I was 13, so like that don't apply to me, but I'm talking about in generalities. But there's this attribute of the boomers that they were a little more, I don't know, they were kind of, what do you call it, like a tell it like it is person kind of thing. They were a little less considerate, and that's just the way they were brought up, right? Like, societies evolve, right? And you can't hold this against them. That's what I don't like. We start holding it against these old people that, like, you know, the great example is maybe you've got a grandparent and they call Asian people Orientals still, right? They don't mean anything bad by it. It's just what they've been calling them for 50 years or whatever. And, like, you know, they're trying, you know. You can't burn them to the ground every time someone makes a mistake. Says the white guy who doesn't have any offensive derogatory terms against him. But you know what I'm saying. Like, you got to give people a place to be people. Especially, like, the older people. Like, they, you know, they grew up in a different world. I mean, a lot of these older people, they witness, like, real racial injustices. Not that there's not real racial injustice, but you know what I'm saying. Like, they've seen some horrific stuff in their time. And I'm just saying, when someone gets to a certain age, like, I don't know that it's so easy to pivot. And, like, things change so much now, PC culture, it's like, it's ridiculous, right? But there's the slow removal of this old way of being, and these people are being removed. Lars von Trier is one of them. He's always been controversial. He's always had controversial statements, which used to have a different effect. I mean, I grew up listening to Howard Stern, and like, Howard Stern would be canceled in a heartbeat if he talked today the way he talked in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, it's just, to, you know, you talk like that today and it's bye now. Cancel culture just cuts your throat and you're out of here, which is crazy because we're going to be left with no entertainers. For instance, here's one good instance that kind of plays a role in the film. Lars grew up thinking he was Jewish because that's what his father was. But then on his mother's deathbed, she tells him, oh, by the way, that's not your real dad. Your real dad's German. this is what I'm reading on Wikipedia, right? Take it with a grain of salt. And, like, this guy's obviously got very dark humor. Sure. Surely he does. And I'm going to read you from Wikipedia. It says, he joked that since he was no longer Jewish, he now understands and sympathizes with Hitler, that he is not against the Jews except for Israel, which is a pain in the ass, and that he is a Nazi. Is that a funny joke? No. Is it dark? Yes. But, like, I mean, sometimes humor is the cure. You got to take the sting out of things. Like, how painful is that to know, like, that's not your real father? Like, you know, you watch Mari Povich, that tells you everything you need to know. They'll show you what it's like. That cameraman runs into the back room and people are crying. So, like, this guy goes through a bunch of trauma, as everybody does. And maybe that's his way of coping, is joking about it. Is it an appropriate joke? No. Is it funny? Not really. Is he really a Nazi? I mean, I don't think so. What do I know? But he did apologize. So, like, to me, that counts for something. Now, so that's just one example of his controversial statements in the past. And the next, so today's film that we're going to talk about, in 2018, he said this about it when it released. He said, it celebrates the idea that life is evil and soulless, which is sadly proven by the recent rise of the Homo Trumpus, the Rat King, which is obviously a narrative against Donald Trump. But he's a very controversial guy, and that Trump thing makes itself known in the film when there's a scene where some characters wear red hats. Okay. We'll talk about that later. And one of the big claims is that Lars is a misogynist. That's the big one, that he hates women. Supported by singer Bjork. She was in his 2000 film Dancer in the Dark, which I have not seen. And she claimed she was actually sexually harassed by Lars back in 2017. I don't know. Anyway, she made that statement in 2017. Excuse me. Now, other female actresses like Kristen Dunst and such, they defended Lars. They say he wasn't that kind of guy with them. I don't know. I wasn't there. But people point to the treatment of the women in his films as support for this idea, which, like, is a little bit crazy, right? Like, well, I mean, it's a movie and then it's real life, right? And, like, in his defense, I've seen Antichrist. And I'm going off of memory. I'm pretty sure William Dafoe gets his penis chopped off. Could be wrong. just freestyling here. But maybe, right? I don't know. Here's Nicole Kidman here. This is actually a very good good example of the differences in generations and ideas of what's funny and such. Okay. Listen to this from Wikipedia. I'll just read to you right from it. Nicole Kidman, who starred in Lars von Trier's Dogville, said in an interview with ABC Radio National, quote, I think I tried to quit the film 3 times because he said, I want to tie you up and whip you, and that's not to be kind. I was like, what do you mean? I've come all this way to rehearse with you, to work with you, and now you're telling me you want me to lie. Now you're telling me you want to tie me up and whip me? But that's Lars, and Lars takes his clothes off and stands there naked, and you're like, oh, put your clothes back on, Lars. Please, let's just shoot the film. But he's very, very raw, and he's almost like a child in that he'll say and do anything. And he would have to eat dinner every night. No, he said, let me take that back. And we would have to eat dinner every night, and most of the time, that would end with me in tears because Lars would sit next to me and drink peach schnapps and get drunk and get abusive, and I'd leave. And anyway, then we'd go to work the next morning. So, like, all that stuff is very cancelable, right? Like, you can't do that at work, can you? And maybe that's, like, old Hollywood attitudes. Maybe that's, like, how things used to be. I don't know. I wish I knew. But, you know, all very inappropriate stuff, if true, okay? But you can see how Nicole Kidman, who's, like, also a boomer, she's kind of just like, whatever, like, men are pigs. It's fine. Let's just shoot this film. Like, that's kind of the attitude. Like I'm saying, like, the boomers were had a little more grit. Like, is that good or bad? I don't know. I mean, like, in some ways, like, you got to give people space to be scumbags. Some ways. Like, you can't cancel everybody for everything. In other ways, like, you can't let sexual harassment and abuse go on either. Like, someone's got to stand up and say, look, enough's enough. So, like, you could just see the difference of generations. Like, it's just a different world that the young folks live in now versus the way it used to be and how the boomers are used to just operating and just keeping it moving, you know? Lars's parents were both, like, super liberal communist types. Nudists. Said he went to nudist camp vacations growing up, which explains why maybe he was hanging out with Nicole Kidman naked. I don't know. Said he grew up in a household that had no room for feelings, religion, or employment. Or, I'm sorry, employment. Enjoyment. Big difference. Big difference between employment and enjoyment. Later, he said he's a bad Catholic, but becoming more atheist. So, and from his movies, you could be like, oh yeah, this dude's an atheist. That seems to be the case. Let's talk about the cast. The only thing that really matters, Matt Dillon. He plays Jack, the main character. Everybody else, insignificant. Who cares? No, I'm just kidding. But the roles are very minor. But Matt Dillon's kind of the most recognizable character here, and he's the main the killer, right? All right, let's get into the movie. We're 20 minutes into the show. Let's start this movie. Plot spoilers from here on out. Take this serious because it will definitely alter your viewing experience. So if you have an interest in seeing this movie, after all the stuff I've said, do it now. Because I would argue that I might ruin this whole film for you if you listen past this point. All right, let's go. Basically, the film is about Jack, our serial killer, and a 12-year period in the 70s and 80s up in Washington State where he kills people. And the way the film was presented, if you haven't seen it, it's given us a narrative being told by Jack to a person named Verge, who you don't really see till, you know, 3/4 through the movie. And this is a reference to the Roman poet Virgil, more on Verge in the conclusion, where we're going to talk about the themes of this movie, the reconciliation of male and female, the opposing polarities, good and evil, the alchemical process that Jack goes through. We'll talk about the methods of the murders and the ancient mystery rites. Oh my God, it's all here. But I'm going to go through the film as, you know, as the film unfolds, as it was received by me with my notes, you know, watching it the first time. This is sort of the reaction video. This is, as it's unfolding, I'm realizing stuff, but then at the end of the film, you're like, oh, I get what this is happening now, right? And then you do a little more research, and like, oh, okay, yeah, this all makes sense. But I'm going to give it to you sort of as it unfolded to me. Jack says he's going to discuss 5 formative incidents, so it's like 5 acts to this movie, kind of. And then the epilogue sort of scene, which we'll get into, of course, in part 2. But the first one, very gripping. I mean, within 5 minutes of this movie starting, we've already hit this point of no return of being like, I got to finish this film. This is great. This is really good. because the characters are so intriguing. You're watching it, you know. Jack, he's in a pickup truck, or I'm sorry, a van, a red van, which red, of course, is a symbolic gesture, which will, again, later in the film, come across. And he's driving down this sort of, you know, woodsy area of Washington. And there's Uma Thurman broken down on the side of the road with her flat tire, but her jack's all busted up. And he pulls over and he's like, he doesn't know how to talk to human beings. You can tell he's like a total weirdo. And she's kind of like, hey, you want to give me a ride? And he's like, sure. And she gets in the truck and she starts like, it's so bizarre because she's talking to him and she's like, I shouldn't have done this. What if you're a serial killer? You know, you could bury my body over here. Look at that. You could turn here and bury my body. Just make sure you did it 6 feet under. Like, it's, you're like, what is this lady doing? Because right now you don't know, is Jack the killer yet? We don't know. Is Uma the killer? Like, she's acting like the killer at this point. And Jack is like getting really annoyed. He takes her to get her jack fixed. The blacksmith fixes it. And they're driving back. She's still being stupid. And the jack breaks again. And I'm just realizing now, Jack and Jack, right? So Jack is using the broken jack. And it breaks. And this, again, I'm freestyling here. I just watched this movie, so it's pretty fresh. Jack has his mental break at this point. Because the jack breaks. The red jack. By the way, the jack is red. They keep zooming in on it, showing you the jack is red. So he has a mental break induced by Uma Thurman's character, this woman who's like just being a total bitch to him. And you're like, why are you provoking this guy? You're like, you kind of know he's going to be the killer, but you're like, dude, what are you doing? And it breaks, and she harasses him into giving her a ride back to the blacksmith one more time. And he's like, look, I'm busy. And she's like, nope, you're going to take me. And she's like, hurry up. And so they're driving, and she's still harassing him. She goes, you know what? I don't think you could be a serial killer. You're too much of a wimp. And that's when he hits the brakes, and he grabs that red jack, and he bashes her face in with it. And there you go. It's on and popping. 10 minutes into the movie, and you're like, whoa. This got hardcore real quick. And he takes her body to a freezer that he had bought. A big walk-in freezer for pizzas. Frozen pizzas. Which, by the way, he says he ate one and it wasn't good. So there's a few pizzas in there still. And it made me really hungry for shitty frozen pizza too, by the way. I don't know why. Disturbing, right? I don't know what that says about me. Anyway, he takes this body to the freezer, which ends up being a place where he stores all the bodies for all the murders. They don't show every murder in this movie. You find out there's at least 61 of them. You see just a handful of them. Yeah, and usually I watch films in like 15-minute chunks because like I just, not that I'm like that busy or that interesting or that cool. I don't know. I have a hard time. Like, if it's a movie I'm watching for work, you know, quote unquote work, like I'll watch it in 15-minute chunks. But this one, like, I mean, it pulled me in. I was like, this is wild. I got to watch this. So the first murder, the first incident that happens, and we go back to the narration. Okay. And Jack is narrating to Verge, this unseen character, who I thought at this point in the movie was the shrink. I thought it was like a shrink that he was recapping all this to. We'll later find out that's not the case. But he compares murder to art and architecture and God. And he calls God the great architect.
Oh dear, you are a dangerous man. Smacked her with the jack, did you? Honestly, I've heard of more murders than I can count. And by the way, what does this ridiculous man have to do with anything?
It's Glenn Gould, one of the greatest piano players of our time. He represents art.
So a jack in the face of an admittedly unbearable lady was great art. Is that what I'm to make of it?
Dear Mr. Verge, please give me a chance. to cast some supplemental light on the story of the Jack. The old cathedrals often have sublime artworks hidden away in the darkest corners for only God to see. Or whatever one feels like calling the great architect behind it all. The same goes for murder. When I say cathedrals, and it's first and foremost the Gothic buildings we admire. Here, elegant pointed arches have replaced the earlier, more primitive, rounded arches. The art of engineering is first and foremost about statics. That is, so things remain standing in spite of the various forces that impact the buildings. In this way, the pointed arch created a possibility to build much higher and with much more light, but most importantly, with less use of material. I often say that the material does the work. In other words, it has a kind of will of its own, and that by following it, the result will be the most exquisite.
So the material was the Jack, and it jumped into the lady's face on its own.
Art is many things.
Very convenient and unusual in the pile of bad excuses. But all of that is of no interest whatsoever unless you are an engineer.
I am an engineer.
Now, all this talk about the material doing the work, they use that phrase, doing the work. It's a reference to the great work, the alchemical process, Freemasonry, all of these things, all of the above. And when you look at alchemy, Paracelsus taught in alchemy there are three basic materials that form all things: salt, sulfur, and mercury. Sulfur and mercury are the opposing forces, sulfur being male, mercury being female, and salt being the offspring, the divine child. And this comes up in many ways. A term we can all recognize is E equals MC squared, right, in science. Well, that also presents itself in alchemy, 500 years prior to the discovery of the formula by Einstein. Energy is sulfur, mercury is light, mass is salt, E equals MC squared. Now, the secrets of alchemy were passed down through all these mystery schools, okay? In secret, right? But secrets of alchemy were also presented and passed down symbolically and in architecture as a way of protecting the secrets, as a sort of subtle nod. Which is why I would argue that symbolism to this day in entertainment is in fact revealing truths and secrets of the occult to other initiates or people that are in the know. You're now in the know. I'm giving out the revelation of the method here, or at least as I interpret it. I could be wrong. Been wrong before, I'll be wrong again. But yeah, how interesting that architecture was used to pass on these secret ideas and secret knowledge. And here our killer is talking about God and architecture. Now in alchemy, sticking on that topic of the material doing the work, they believe that this god Thoth or Hermes, like Hermes Trismegistus, which is where your Hermetic laws come from, the order of the Hermetic Dawn, right? The Golden Order of Hermetic Dawn. Does that sound right? I don't think that's right. You know what I'm saying, though. Thoth and Hermes, this god was the master of the three planes of existence, the mind, the body, and the soul. This is the physical, spiritual, and mental states. This is earth, heaven, and the in-between, okay? And the alchemist, their job was to take the materials given to them and through a process of like distillation, coagulation, all this stuff, they were to refine an object down to its basic constituents and rebuild it such that it would be perfected. And one method of doing this was through the Philosopher's Stone. The Philosopher's Stone was more than just a physical object, though. It was the material of Earth, with the power to evolve and unite man's soul into the oneness, the one global consciousness stuff. Man can become immortal. They talk about turning lead into gold, and that was more of a spiritual transmutation, not necessarily getting rich off gold, okay? So Jack, he's talking about architecture. He's building a house, which this ties us into the Freemasons. The Freemasons are the architects. In fact, that big G you see in the Freemason compass and square is a reference to the great architect, which is the exact verbiage that Jack uses. And Jack is building a house. And what do you think those Freemasons did, you know, literally, not, you know, before you got into like speculative Freemasonry? They were builders. That's what the compass and square are for, the trowel and all that stuff and the apron. And Jack, he says he's an engineer, he always wanted to be an architect, and he always wanted to build his own house. Hence the name of the film, The House That Jack Built. Because Jack is going on a spiritual journey of Freemason ideas, of the occult, of the alchemical processes. It is the house that Jack built. And Jack also, by the way, has obsessive compulsive disorder. And they joke about how crazy it is that a serial killer would have OCD, because he's got to like keep everything neat and clean. Now we move on to the second incident. The second incident, Jack decides he's going to strangle this lady, basically. And he shows up at her house and, you know, gets in there and strangles her. Well, that's an oversimplification, because it's quite horrific. See, he strangles her, and this is his first murder by strangulation. It's assumed, I guess, because you can tell he's a bit nervous about killing still. The first killing that we saw was Uma Thurman, and like the jack broke and he bashed her head, and it was very violent and angry. But this is more premeditated. He's like, I'm going to do this. This is my thing now, I guess. And he goes up to her house and she lets him in and he strangles her, but he doesn't keep her, strangled long enough. And she's actually like, he thinks she's dead, but she's not. And she starts like kind of gasping and like choking on her tongue. And it's really horrific. I mean, it's like, I don't know, like watching an animal die. I've never hunted, but it's like if you hunted and you shot it and it was just wounded, it's like, oh my God, like, please stop this now. She starts kind of gasping and he seems like, I don't know, to feel bad. So this poor woman, she's grasping for air, unable to move, lying on the ground, and he sort of feels bad and he gets a thermos out. And it's revealed that he is drinking chamomile tea and he's trying to give her some chamomile tea. Now, I should know that, like, being an avid coffee drinker, that's a real sociopath thing to do, drink tea, I think. I don't like tea. I'm anti-tea. I'm on team coffee all day. And this just further supports that idea. Only serial killers drink tea and walk around with a thermos full of it. But he ends up killing her. And, like, he puts this is where, like, it's so disturbing. He puts a knife in her, like, barely dead heart, and it's, like, squirting blood, and it's just, like, WTF. It's, like, super realistic. I mean, I guess. Obviously, I've never seen this firsthand. But, like, because I guess it's because, like, he screws up killing her first, and she's just kind of horrifically wounded. And just shows that he's kind of like learning, like it's a learning process, which I imagine would be pretty realistic if you like don't really know, you're not violently like killing people, like you're just trying to learn as you go, I guess. And at this point, it seems very like American Psycho-esque. Like the guy reminds me of Patrick Bateman, like with the OCD. Somehow he's way less likable, though. If you could find Patrick Bateman likable, I don't know. And anyways, so he kills the woman. He wraps her up in bubble wrap and puts her in the van. And what do you know? Here comes a cop. And the cop asks, he pulls up to the van. He's like, what are you doing here at this house? And he's like, oh, I wanted to talk to, old girl, whatever her name was, Ma Duke's here. And he was like, okay, get out the van. and they go up to the house and they end up searching the house. And Jack's like, oh, you should really look at this house. You should comb it over, because he's basically trying to distract him so he can grab the body and get it out of there. So, I don't know, I forgot him. He actually saw the cop, pulls the body out of the van, throws it in the bushes next to the van, because he knew the cop was going to look through the van, which he did. And now he's like kind of basically distract this cop, and the cop's finally like, okay, get out of here. So he gets out of there and he goes and grabs the body, ties it with a rope to the van, and hauls ass out of there, dragging this body behind him. Very brazen. Also very disturbing. You see like a trail of like the blood from this corpse as he's driving away. And he drives it all the way down to the alley, down to where the freezer is. And it's very, very gross. He stops and he looks and he sees this trail of blood and he's like, oh my God, I'm about to get caught. There's a blood trail leading directly to the freezer, to my van. And then here comes the rain to wash away the trail of blood.
The great rain. It washed away the long track from my escape. Now, I don't consider myself a decidedly devoted man of faith, which of course is a totally crazy thing to say considering our present situation, but I must admit, I experienced the rain, the fiercest I have ever seen, as a kind of a blessing. And the murder as a kind of liberation. I felt I had a higher protector.
And in reality, you were just a terrifying, perverted Satan.
Now, ironically, I just realized the irony of this. I'm actually drinking tea as I'm recording this. Because when I take little breaks to play the little clip, I take a little sip. All right. And I drink tea. Actually, I'm trying to cut back on the coffee. It's too much caffeine, but I still hate tea, and I'm team coffee all day. Anyway, let's keep it to the movie. So the rain comes, and it's almost like God is looking out for him, or Satan, I would argue. And he even acknowledged it. And Verge says, you're more like Satan. And what's disturbing in the movie, the rain comes, and it's washing away the blood. And he flips this body over. And like, you know, Lars von Trier shows you everything. Which I don't like. I love horror movies. I don't like this too much. I like the too much. I like the 70s, like Halloween, you know, like it's brutal. And he's killing people, but like it's mostly in the shadows. You don't really see the blood. Like Carpenter's 1978 Halloween. I don't think there's one drop of blood, if I'm not mistaken. Could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. I don't need to see it. Like, show me like it's happening in a way that's creative and doesn't get too gory. I don't want this picture burned in my brain for the next week. And that's what happens in this movie. He flips over the body and sure enough, there's the face all ground away from driving miles on the road with it. Ugh. Then, you know, between the murder scenes, there's like narration and there's like, I don't know, little film ensemble things. And during this one, Jack is doing this sort of card flipping thing that if you've ever seen, there was an NXS video in the, was it 80s or 90s? I don't remember the name of it, the song, but you know what I'm talking about, Lori. Like, he's standing there with a deck of white, I don't know, 12 by 18 sheets, and he flips away one word at a time, right? And that's kind of what he's doing here. Now, I had only found out because, you know, being a, like a Gen Xer slash millennial type, that this was done back by Bob Dylan back in the day. I saw this, I don't know what I was watching. Bob Dylan did it in some music video thing forever ago. I thought NXS, my whole life I thought NXS came up with that. Nope, Bob Dylan. Then you see Jack at home, and he's cutting out photographs of people that have emotions and stuff, and he starts emulating the emotions in the mirror like a real sociopath, because he doesn't have emotions. Which, this ties us into the theory that this movie is really about Lars von Trier, because as you recall from my preamble, Lars says he grew up in a house where you couldn't have emotions. Then he's flashing back to his youth when Jack was a child, and he talks about how he was like sort of hiding out in the fields, and he would enjoy watching these farmers who were in a formation back in the day. They used to cut down the reeds with a scythe, like a sickle. I don't know what you call this, but you know, the scythe is what the Grim Reaper holds, right? You know what I'm talking about. Well, this ties us into some ideas. The act of using the scythe, this act is done when it's time to harvest the crops, when it's time for death and the rebirth process, okay? This could be equivalent to what makes Jack want to kill. He is the Saturnian force with the scythe. It's time to kill. Now, of course, Saturn, shown as the Grim Reaper with the scythe, because in terms of mythology, which again, we already know Lars von Trier gets into mythology, the forces of Saturn or Kronos, they are the things that introduce the material world. And we talked about the divine material. It's a Saturnian force. The Saturnian force, in terms of mythology, introduced the limitations of time and measurement. Time, of course, introduces the idea of death, which some would say that the Bible, like, man used to live forever, and it wasn't until the Saturnian forces came and introduced the constructs and the constraints of measurements and time that man now was introduced to death through the snake, through the Luciferian force. Saturn is also symbolic in alchemy, as lead, as the first stage of the process. So in some ways, Jack, as a boy, is starting his alchemical process. He's introduced to the blackening, the Saturnian first stage, the Negredo, whatever you want to call this. It's the alchemical process, and it happens in this scene. Now, if you want to get real crazy, which I know you do, there's a thing called the Fraternity of Saturn, this Brotherhood of Saturn. And they were it's like an occult group, basically. They taught some of Aleister Crowley's ideas of Thelema. They talked about like magic and all this stuff. And it has its roots in the Scandinavian lodges. Note that Lars is from Scandinavia, from Denmark. Is there a connection there? No clue. There might be, though. Maybe someone knows more about Lars von Trier than I do. They can let me know if they find that. Maybe Lars was indoctrinated into these esoteric teachings. Who knows? In the Fraternity of Saturn, though, there's a guy named Gregor Gregorius. That's his like magic name. That wasn't his real name. And his teachings were about how humans are caught between two polarities. Talk about this all the time with the reconciliation of opposites. Life or creativity. Because again, creativity ties us into art, ties us into the dark forces. Death or destruction. So you got life on one pole, death on the other. Creativity on one pole, destruction on the other. Good on one pole, evil on the other. But both polarities are necessary to evolve or initiate man into the knowledge, the gnosis, the wisdom that he seeks to become perfected. And these occultists, they thought, at least in the fraternity of Saturn, that only the elites will understand this and understand this worldview, and only the elites can evolve and reach this, you know, immortal stage, this philosopher's stone. The masses, they're too stupid. They're mouth breathers. They will never get it. They're prisoners of the unconsciousness. And they said, Gregorius said, darkness precedes light. Without darkness, there is no light. So on one hand, the initiate, to become perfected, has to embrace the darkness. And it's only because of the social constructs by the mouth breathers that we think that it's bad to embrace evil, basically. And then Jack cuts a duck's leg off. So there you go. He cuts a duck's leg off as a boy. They show it. They show him taking some, like, you know, dikes or whatever and cutting this duck's leg off. I'm like, God, please make it stop. Why do I watch these movies? I hate seeing that. I don't want to see that. But don't worry, I stayed and watched the credits, and sure enough, it said that animals were not hurt. It looked very real. I hope that's true. I hope animals were not hurt, because that was very disturbing. And then he throws the duck in the pond, and it, like, can't swim. It's like, good night. It takes, like, an evil mind to put this on screen. Now, they go back to sort of, not present day, but, like, back to the murder times, the 12 years. He's been freezing bodies, and he's kind of getting bored with it, and his OCD kicks in, okay? And this whole time he's been taking photos. I didn't mention that yet, but it comes up in the plot. He's been taking photos of all the murders, because, you know, it's like Dexter, you know, he has to take that piece of blood and the Petri dish stuff with him. And he decides he doesn't like the photos anymore, and he needs to take these frozen corpses back to the original murder scene and recreate the photos. And along the way, he's killing people. You know, like, he's going off the rails. And, like, you watch it, and, like, you just keep saying, what the hell, dude? Stop, man. Like, it's very upsetting. And there's another reference here, and he references William Blake. And this is when I was like, okay, Illuminate confirmed this movie all the way. He talks about the lamb and the tiger.
Could you elaborate a little on why the old lady had to die?
I can't explain it all, but perhaps I can describe it as the kind of blood frenzy an ermine experiences in a henhouse. Do you know Blake's poems about the lamb and the tiger?
I do know Blake superficially, but I'm afraid I won't escape a comprehensive tutorial.
God created both the lamb and the tiger. The lamb represents innocence, and the tiger represents savagery. Both parts are perfect and necessary. The tiger lives on blood and murder, kills the lamb. And that is also the artist's nature.
You read Blake like the devil reads the Bible. After all, the poor lamb didn't ask to die in order to become even the greatest art.
The lamb has been bestowed with the honor of living forever in art. And art is divine.
So again, we've got this opposing polarities idea. You got the innocence of the lamb versus the savagery of the tiger. And you've got art being divine and immortal. And murder is part of art in his mind. He is the architect, the artist. Murder is his medium. Or his method, I should say. But the argument here is that both parts are perfect. And this is, again, representative of the opposing polarities, the Saturnian ideas of all that stuff. And it's a bit of Church of Satan, too. Man is just an animal. He has animalistic urges, and man should satisfy them. And in defense of Church of Satan, It's only if, you know, consenting adults are involved or whatever. But yeah, this is like the lamb versus the tiger. Like every person has bits of lamb and tiger within them. And, you know, according to some of these folks in the occult, they would argue that social constructs and society, they stifle the tiger. They want everyone to be a lamb. Is that right? Is that wrong? You decide. And we'll come back to Blake one more time in the conclusion, because there's a lot more to talk about with William Blake. But at this point, Verge and Jack are, like, you know, having a conversation about everything. And Verge is like, that van, you're putting all these bodies in, it's getting pretty bloody. That's pretty dangerous and reckless for you to drive around with all this blood in the van. And Jack says, sometimes the best way to hide is to not hide at all. Again, this is the ideas hidden in plain sight. All this symbolism that you've seen, that we've been talking about for 10 years now. They hide it in plain sight. And maybe revelation of the method is the process. Maybe I'm helping them. Am I? I don't know. Now, there's this scene where they're looking at the photos and the negatives, and the quality of the demonic, the dark light, as he's looking at these negatives.
For me, though, what was really sensational about the work with the photo, it wasn't the image, but the negative. When I was 10 years old, I discovered that through the negative, you could see the real inner demonic quality of the light. The dark light.
Note the terms that he uses. He's talking about the work. He says the work. This is the great work of Freemasonry, of the initiate, going through the process of enlightenment, through the Gnosis, through the wisdom, through the Sophia. It's the alchemical journey of reconciling these opposing polarities by embracing the dark, the negative, or the dark light that he's referring to when talking about the photos. That's what that means. And he decides he's going to mail these photos to the local newspaper, which this part of the plot doesn't make sense. It doesn't really ever pick up. But the zip code on the letter is 98632. I looked that up because I'm a little crazy myself. And it's revealed to be a town called Longview in the state of Washington. All right. Of course, he's from the Northwest. Bunch of weirdos up there. I joke. I kid. But most of the people I've met from Oregon are pretty weird. I grew up, my best friend was from Washington. So shout out my best friend out there in Washington. But yeah, then I thought, oh my God, Washington, isn't that where Bill Gates is from? Bill Gates, is he a serial killer? He kind of looks like Jack with the same square spectacles and everything. Got a little bit of like OCD. Maybe that's Bill Gates. Fun fact, the other thing that made me think of Green Day, and I looked it up, and sure enough, the song Longview is about the city of Longview, Washington. Why? I don't know. The song is about waxing your carrot. So I don't know. He says, you know, in the song, the lyrics, he says, sit around and watch the phone, but no one's calling. Which is prophetic, because in 1992, you couldn't, wax the carrot with a phone, and now you could. Right? See that? See how weird that is? He sits around and watches the phone, and the song is all about, you know, carrot waxing. And fast forward, was it 10, 20, like 20, 30 years? Damn, 30 years? Man, I'm old. 30 years, and you could sit around and watch the phone and wax the carrot. So, there you go. Fun fact. Next, Verge. He's having deeper and deeper conversations as the movie progresses, okay? And he's asking, he says, what about repentance? And Verge says, like, the people I deal with repent all the time, which at the time, this doesn't make sense. You'll find out why that is here soon enough. And Jack, he's like, I don't repent anything. Because again, this is the idea. There's no such thing as evil. doesn't exist. Why repent if there's nothing wrong with doing murder and stuff? Now, more importantly, you'll hear talk about shadows and how they change in density and size. And that plays a role in this, too.
But what about repentance, Jack? The ones I deal with tend to repent all over the place.
I repent nothing, no matter how long we have to walk. But I did think of something the other day. Imagine a man walking down a street underneath the street lamps. Right under a light, his shadow is the densest, but also the tiniest. Then when he starts to move, his shadow grows in front of him. The shadow becomes bigger and bigger while it thins out. And the shadow behind him from the next lamppost emerges and becomes shorter and shorter until it reaches its ultimate density as the man stands directly underneath the light. Let's say that the man standing underneath the first lamppost is me when I've just committed a murder. I feel strong and content. I start to walk and the shadow in front of me grows bigger, like my pleasure. But at the same time, pain is on its way, represented by the shadow behind me from the next lamppost. And at the midpoint between the lampposts, the pain is so great, it outweighs my pleasure. And with every step forward, pleasure dissolves and pain intensifies behind me. Finally, the pain is so unbearably intense that I have to act. So when I reach the point with the next lamp and zenith, I will kill again.
He's talking about the light and the dark and the shadows, right? And about how the light will change in strength and density depending on where he's at. It's like a cyclical nature, right? And it implies that he feels best and feels strongest when murdering. It's the cycle of pain versus strength. And every street lamp provides this new, you know, reinvigoration based on the shadow. And, you know, the shadow is something we've talked about many, many, many times. It's this idea of embracing the dark. I would, if you're not familiar with this, because I don't want to belabor the point too hard, read my book, The Dark Path, which, again, you'll get if you sign up for Patreon or Illuminati Watcher VIP section. I'll give you a free copy of it, ebook copy. Or you can get it on Amazon or Audible. I narrated it. Lots of great reviews for this book. This is my magnum opus, as it were. My greatest understanding of all these ideas synthesized into one book. Get The Dark Path, my friend. Anyway, in the book, we talked about creativity a lot. Because Carl Jung said that creativity in man resides inside the shadow. And this is where the symbols speak to us. That's why the symbolism is a language to the subconscious. And this ties into, Kenneth Grant, another occultist. He talked about how the source of human creativity comes from the mauve zones. And, you know, we get into the mauve zone as a dream state, the source of artistic impulses, the place where contact can be had with divine and demonic forces. So, like, again, this ties into all the ideas of this movie with all of its talk about art and creating art and embracing the dark and embracing the shadow, which also, by the way, we talked about the shadow a bunch on my Kobe Bryant shows from early 2020. When I read Kobe Bryant's kids' books that he wrote, and shockingly, the idea in the one book was that the athletic child, embraced his shadow, and the shadow was dark and evil, but boy, did that shadow increase this athlete's abilities. That's what Kobe was teaching your kids. Don't blame me. Now, third incident. We're only on the third incident of the movie. I mean, already there's, you know, it's been implied or at least shown. I mean, there's been at least 10, 20 murders or something. And this might be the worst one. It might be the worst. I mean, they're all bad in their own right. This one is pretty horrific. He's taking like a girl on a date, a woman on a date. And the woman has like her two sons with her. And you know, there's no background. They just kind of start showing this. And he's taking them out in the wood, in the woods, and he's going to show them how to hunt and shoot. And this is where he puts the red hats on everybody. He's like, for safety, we wear red hats. And this is very similar to the Donald Trump stuff. And, you know, previously, Lars von Trier had this statement about Trump. And what we're presuming is, like, he's trying to build a family. And you're like, oh, was there a moment where Jack wasn't a homicidal maniac? And, you know, the woman seems really happy, and she's very proud that, like, Jack's taking on this fatherly figure role, and he's showing the sons how to, like, this is how you shoot a gun and how you hunt. And, you know, Jack's kind of like, look, you know, the one boy's like, did you kill an animal before? And he was like, I have, but I'm not proud of it. You know, like, you hunt for, you know, more noble purposes or whatever. Now, oddly enough, he's sort of saying the thing, because like any good serial killer, he's putting on a face to the world that's not true to his own sort of will. Talking about how this whole hunting thing displeases him. And he doesn't like how people show off their dead animals as trophies. Which, of course, he's got a freezer full of dead bodies. Yeah, anyway, so this is all happening. And the next thing you know, he's up in this, you know, it kind of cuts the scene. And next thing you know, he's on top of this tower and he's shooting at the family. He's taking out the young boys first. And, like, your jaw just drops. And you're like, what in the actual F is happening here? I mean, and like, he just got done teaching these kids this lesson on, like, how you, and I don't know anything about hunting, like, not my thing. Something about, like, how when you hunt a deer, you don't kill the mother, you kill the biggest, I don't know, fawn. What's a deer child called? A fawn? Light me up in the comments. Anyway, so, like, you don't shoot the mother, because if you kill the mother, now the two baby deer, they're going to die for sure, because there's no mother to take care of them. So you shoot the biggest baby deer so that mother can keep reproducing and taking care of the other one, the survivor. And sure enough, that's what he does. He starts picking off the boys. And you would think, for a moment, you're like, Lars isn't going to show that. Yep, he does. He shoots a kid. Then, like, this is every Lars von Trier movie. It goes from bad to worse to unbearably worse. He shoots the boys, and he makes the mother, she's still alive, but she's, like, obviously in complete shock. He makes the mother feed the dead son pie. And you're just like, dude. But wait, there's more. He asks her, he's like, what's your favorite number? And she's like, my favorite number is 12. He says, that's an excellent number. And then he gives her to the count of 12 to escape. But she's so numb, she's just kind of stumbling around and walking. And so he basically just pops her from the sniper rifle tower there. Now, it is curious that she chose 12. You know, 12 disciples of Christ, 12 signs of the zodiac, all that stuff. But, like, this hunting thing is like the Darwinian stuff that the Church of Satan would embrace. Not, you know, like, just to defend the Church of Satan, like, they wouldn't embrace, like, shooting unarmed kids and stuff. But, like, there's a sort of Darwinian evolutionary idea. You know, it's like the strength of the strongest animal is what should reign supreme. Right? Now, at this point in the film, I've already committed in saying, this might be the most disturbing film of all time. Worse than Hereditary. And in some ways, it might be the greatest horror film of all time. Because to elicit such a disturbing response, you know, which I haven't really felt since watching, like, Faces of Death, which isn't a horror movie, really. But, like, he just keeps ratcheting up the horror to the point where you just want to tap out. You're like, I don't even want to watch this anymore. But you do. Because, like, he's actually, like, a really great filmmaker. Like, almost like Stanley Kubrick, where it's, like, everything's, like, very artistic. And I don't know how to describe it because I'm not a film critic. I've got a book on it. I'm trying to read it and understand how to talk to you better, so I don't sound like such an idiot. But like the way he films it, like it's just engrossing, and you're like, dude, I can't stop watching this. Like the count of 12 thing, like good night. Oh, and by the way, like it gets worse. Like he counts to 12. She's like in shock, walking away, jogging, and he pops her, and she's not dead yet. So he walks up to her, and then they show a close-up, and he shoots her at point-blank with the rifle. It's just like, oh, my God. Just when you think it can't get worse, here we go. Here we go. So there you go. That's the end of part one. Part two, again, going to be for the bonus stuff for our supporters only. Shout out to my supporters. You should be one of them. If you like the show, if you like the stuff I'm presenting, if you want more information, you know where to go. There's three places. Patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher, where you'll get that free copy of The Dark Path so you can learn all about the shadow. You could go to IlluminatiWatcher.com in the VIP section, which is essentially the same as Patreon. A little less community involvement, but some people don't like Patreon, so there you go. You'll also get The Dark Path there. Or you can go to rockfin.com/creator/Isaac and sign up, and you'll get all kinds of stuff. You won't get the book, but you'll get all kinds of other stuff. Like you'll get the uncensored version of my other shows that I do, Inside the Mind of a Conspiracy Theorist, where we talk about spars recently, and Breaking Social Norms with Mrs. Weishaupt, the uncensored version of that as well. So there you go. There's three options for you. I've got the comparison on IlluminatiWatch.com in the VIP section. You can compare all three and see which one you like. One of them is just right for you. And once you unlock that, you'll get part two, where we're going to talk about the meaning of the ending. Because once you watch this movie and you see the ending, you're going to say, what in the hell is happening here? Isaac, guide me. Tell me. I'll tell you. Talk about alchemy and the spiritual warfare that ultimately is what this movie's all about. Which is what this whole world is all about. So there you go. Links in the show notes. It's your move. Till next time, stay woke.